But now that kind of syllogism isn't going to get you hurt, is it? But how about this one? U.S. equals capitalism. Capitalism equals freedom. Ergo what?
You want to see them everywhere.
Ergo what?
U.S. equals freedom.
And the problem is now, again, we get to the definition problem again. What is freedom? Is freedom simply to buy and sell if I have money? But if I don't, forget it? Is that what it is? Or is freedom being able to cast a ballot from a rigged menu? Tweedledee versus Tweedledum and Dumber, but have no say in the menu itself? We had a rigged menu and two stolen elections. While we're lecturing the rest of the world about democracy and freedom, I just love that one. In terms of disenfranchising voters, by the way, that's called criminal conspiracy, in case you wondered. When you set out to disenfranchise a class of people based on their likely voting proclivities, that is criminal conspiracy. You understand that? And one of the reasons why the rest of the world sees globalization the way they do is because they're tired of it. Because all they've ever known is this kind of globalization. Do what we tell you to do or else we will bomb the crap out of you. We will make sure you don't get that World Bank loan because we have absolute veto power in the World Bank. We'll make sure you don't get that IMF loan because we have absolute veto power in the IMF. We'll make sure that the WTO ruling does not go your way because we have decisive power in the WTO. Because of our allotments. And so another reason why this debate is so contentious is because you have to look from outside America. And a lot of the people in this country have never been anywhere to speak of. Or if they've been anywhere, it's at some damn 5-star hotel in Tijuana or whatever. They've never lived in the language, worked in the languages, and lived in those places and seen those places. How many people here have been on an Indian reserve? And please open up for cigarettes or booze. You have. How'd you like it?
It was tough.
Yeah, it's really tough. Canada, they live on $229 a month.
But you know, it's starting to look better than living here.
Well, that's what the natives...
With all of this, like you just got through saying, you were going to that place, right?
Yeah.
They're oblivious to this.
Well, what they're saying is we're the lucky ones because we know what brownouts are like anyway. Whereas the people here just freak out if the TV goes out for an hour, they go crazy.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely just go berserk. Oh, my football game! Yeah. Son of a power gets on before halftime's over. Start fidgeting, getting really nervous.
Go down to the pro agents.
Yeah. So because economics means different things to different folks depending upon their paradigm, so does globalization mean different things to different folks based on the paradigm.
You're listening to a talk on the economics of globalization by Professor James Craven of Clark College. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We continue with the conclusion of Professor Craven's talk.
Now, here's another one for you. They say globalization means what? It means not only the integration, interdependence of various regions and sectors and nations and cultures, right, of the global economy, but it means what? The spreading of progress. Right? Because through the magic of the markets, whenever there are shortages, then prices will rise. Whenever there are surpluses, then prices will fall until we get what? An equalization. So So one of the things that's said about globalization is what? Well, the good news is what? When there are shortages of labor, those wages in Mexico are going to rise. The real wages are going to rise. Those Mexicans are going to start buying all sorts of other value-added products, high-value-added, high-wage products from us as they become more middle class. That's part of the promise. Right? Now what happens is our people who lose their jobs in manufacturing, that's okay, because they're going to come to Clark and to Wazoo. They're going to get retrained. They're going to come here, having worked at James River or wherever, right? Now they're out of work. But they're going to train themselves to become computer analysts or whatever. And those Mexicans, as their wages start to rise, and as unemployment drives other wages down, until what? Until we get what's called equalization. Because under the market model, prices, interest rates, rents, wages tend to equalize as labor, capital, and so on move from areas of surpluses into areas of shortages, and so on. What has been the experience? Well, the experience has been that in some cases, very limited cases, real wages in outsourcing areas have risen faster than real wages have fallen in the areas from which the outsourcing came, such as the United States or Canada. But the empirical evidence is that those cases are, so far anyway, rare. In fact, there's more of a race to the bottom than a pulling up to the top. If you look at real wages, and that's the only way to talk. If you're an economist, the only way to talk is in real terms because of the veil of money. Talking inflation-adjusted terms. So if we're talking inflation-adjusted terms, real wages have fallen from the bottom 80% of income earners from around 1971 up to around 1992-93. They held constant for the next 15%, and only the top 5% did real wages and earnings actually rise. And in fact, of those rises, over 60% of all those increases went to the top 1%. Okay? Inequality. Well, here's another problem we've got. We've got a society where everything is commodified, including what? Including legal representation, including health care. We have 44 million people with no health care in this country. Another 37 million people with marginal health care. While we're lecturing the rest of the world about how U.S. equals capitalism and capitalism equals freedom. Right on. I just came from Canada. Yes, I have to wait. But my health care is covered through collective stuff because the right to health care is the right to life itself. So when I hear pro-life people call themselves pro-life, I always ask them, are you really? Are you pro-life or pro-birth? There's a difference. Pro-birth means just the right to pop out the hatch and not be aborted. Pro-life means what? Right of access to the means of life. What are the means of life? Shelter? Yeah. Healthcare? Yeah. Food? Yeah. How about political representation? Yeah. How about legal representation? Recently in Illinois, for example, out of 25 people on death row, 13 of them got turfed off. One of them was waiting 45 minutes. Why? Because law is for sale. Justice is for sale. You got enough money, you can kill your ex-wife and the guy who brought back her sunglasses. And within 2 years, you could be out on the golf course looking for the real killer, who must have been either a golfer or a golf fan or a caddy, because that's the only place you can find OJ, looking for the real killer. The problem is when you have a society where everything's for sale, the right to life is for sale itself, the right to justice is for sale itself. That's the problem. And the problem is those who don't have it because of their birth or whatever, because they're locked out, they have two choices. Either you have a system that makes room for them, or they're going to start reading Karl Marx. Or perhaps join the fascists, go on the ultra-right with the militias and whatever. But they're going to get very alienated and very angry. And that's why the rich people don't understand. See, the liberal says to the conservatives, you guys are idiots. That's why Lenin, Vladimir, not John,
You said when it comes time to hang the last capitalist, he'll probably be the one who sold us the rope. Because the capitalists are notoriously myopic and narrow and short-term oriented. And then when they screw up, what do? They go to the state to bail them out, don't they? The same anti-government people are there with their old handouts, like Enron and the rest of them. So what's happening with globalization is not just globalization of markets, folks, but globalization of whole value systems, of whole institutions. And with that, you've got the makings of some serious, serious contradictions. Because why do you think other people want to be penetrated and screwed over and exploited and told that their own cultures are trash any more than we do? We don't appreciate it if a foreign power tries to overthrow our government, an engineer coup. We don't appreciate it when somebody foreign comes in and says, your American institutions suck. You Americans are selfish, stupid, ignorant, backward people. That's why we go to war, so we can learn geography. Every time we bomb the crap out of somebody, we find out where that country's located, how to spell it, and what countries are around it. That's how we teach geography in America. We go to war. We're bombing them. Might as well find out who we're bombing, where they are. And the point is, we've now seen, by the way, from globalization, globalization also means what? Whenever you have increasing integration and interdependence, it's both good news and bad news, isn't it? On the one hand, it's good news because what? Some markets create what? Other markets, right? Some markets create jobs and incomes and tax revenues, right? What are called multiplier and spread effects. And they give people jobs and incomes from which they then what? Demand other products and services. They trade, right? And so markets create markets. Demand creates derivative demand. Supply creates derivative supply. You see? On the input and the output level. That's wonderful. But the bad news is what? As the globe becomes more interdependent, over there is no longer over there. As we found out through Mount St. Helens, where they were getting ash in Japan, as we're finding out as countries like China and India are industrializing more rapidly in non-green ways, because they want a piece of the pie too. And these countries have real needs, and they're getting ugly. Because how many wars do you think we're going to fight, folks? We can't even handle Iraq. My God, we've got a backdoor draft going. Huh? Got people keeping people in now 2 years, 3 years? Past their time, why? For Iraq? It should be like that, shouldn't it? Isn't that what we were told? It was a cakewalk? Isn't that what Mr. Wolfman said?
Getting flowers.
Yeah, be flowers and be cakewalk. Right?
Here's another problem for you to think about with globalization. Suppose I have two runners. Okay, let's say we've got a race going here, okay? Here's the finish line, okay? Right here. And here's the start. Well, let's say I hold one runner back at the start until the other runner has gone halfway around the track. Do you have any doubt who's going to win this race? Now, let's take it further. Suppose the winner of race one gets advanced even further around the track, while the loser of race one gets held back again. Because inequality is dynamic. Inequality produces more inequality. Okay? If you've got enough money, you can be a total moron. It doesn't matter. Former president of the World Bank. Have you guys read the Summers Memo? Mm-hmm. Where he's, well, you should read it. It's wonderful. Eichmann could have written it. It says that basically third world countries are underpolluted. Because it says that, see, the thing is, most of the things with pollution, they don't kill you until around 70. Since those people aren't going to live to 70 anyway, why not pollute the crap out of them? Because they ain't going to make it to 70 anyway. That's one of the things, these lovely little things says. It also says that rich people have more sense of aesthetics than poor people. They have a higher income elasticity demand for aesthetics and so on. This is real Nazi-like. It's called the Summers Memo. Larry, Lawrence Summer, the president of Harvard.
Oh, that's exciting.
The one who says women are backward and inferior when it comes to math and science, that one.
Lawrence Summers.
Yeah, it's called the Summer. So here's the other problem. Globalization is a sure prescription for widening inequalities on a global level, and that's indeed what's happening. A high-tech military cannot defeat a low-tech force. Simplicity will defeat technology every time. That's why the Vietnamese won in Vietnam. Simplicity will defeat complexity every time. See? Just like they say, these guys only have to be right once. So on a global level, and one of the things one of my students asked me, he said, you know, this cliche, why do they hate us? I'm going, first of all, tell me who they are. And second, tell me who us are. So what do you mean? That's just what I just said. What do you mean by us? What do you mean by them? Who are they? Well, you know all those people overseas. Oh, okay. But what do you mean? Well, hate Americans. Does she really think so? Maybe they hate us because we would even dare to ask such a question as that. Why do they hate us? And I asked this person, have you ever heard of Guatemala 1954? Or Iran 1954? Or the Bay of Pigs? Have you ever heard of Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos? South Korea, Taiwan, want a list of all these dictators that we put into power and kept in power that none of us in this room would ever dare to go there. But they kept the wages cheap. They kept the logs cheap. They made sure the unions were gone and they killed commies, any kind of commies around, take care of them. Do you know we had a list of Saddam Hussein? Did you know that? 1984? Of alleged communists. Handed him a list. Our State Department did. For killing, one of them dead. Wound up killing 43,000 alleged communists. Did you know that? And so globalization, from our perspective, is what? It's simply the internationalization of our sacred way of life. That's how it's viewed. The triumph, the internationalization, the interdependence, the integration, right? Of market-based institutions and processes and values and relationships that go with them. The liberal says what? Yes, but capitalism has a raw edge to it. And in order to save capitalism from its own logic, from its own destructive side, because capitalism is sort of like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The same logic that produces this logic here can produce incredibly new drugs to solve a whole bunch of problems. Absolutely true. It can produce new technologies, new markets. It can produce jobs, revenues, differentiated products, inventions, innovation. It can lengthen life, and so on. But it can also produce what? Not only new drugs for certain diseases, but it can produce the diseases for which we need the drugs.
Mm-hmm. That's not so right? Funny. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what does it say to you? What kind of society are we? We spend five times more on Viagra research than on senile dementia and Alzheimer's. The hell is that? What kind of society is that?
The profit.
There you go. Mm-hmm. The profit motive. What's in it for me? And the problem is the textbooks tell you only one side of the story. Just like when I studied econ, I started at the University of Minnesota, all I got was the revealed truths of my illustrious profs. And I was expected to puke it back. Because Lord knows they knew it all. And I'd get even textbooks written by them. So you get cloning, you know, how that goes. They're all going to the conferences and, you know, graduate students are getting primed up. And tenure gets really nasty. Oh, now it's really on your knees time. Counting the days till you can get real. Of course, by that time, you've made so many Faustian deals to get to the point of being real, you're not real anymore. It becomes academic. Because now you're part of the system. And that's part of the problem. Globalization means what? The globe of what? The globalization of certain value systems and ideas. The next question is, as defined by whom? Mm-hmm.
as defined by whom? When I was in China, there was a gentleman from Harvard there. And his basic message to the Chinese was, listen, you people need to get a little bit more on the real on property rights and stuff like that. And if you do, then we can have better trade. But if you don't, we're going to have to come down. Wonderful. China's not the place to be delivering that message. That is not the place. But that's what his message was. His message was, we are America. We'll tell you what's moral, what's immoral, what's right, what's wrong, what's efficient, what's inefficient, what's progressive, what's reactionary. And God help you if you're not on the same page with us. That's no different than Hitler, is it? What we call manifest destiny is nothing more than strict old Lebensraum. What the Israelis, for example, call Hayat Israel, same thing. It's a doctrine of we got the land and screw you. We're going to take it. And we're going to keep it, even if it means becoming the opposite of what we claim we are. We will take it and hold it. And that's what's going on with globalization. And that's why it's not simply, I showed you, for example, how markets are supposed to work, right? First it's commodified, then what? Then supply and demand get together, get it on, have a happening, roll over and have a cigarette, and that determines prices. And prices then tell me what? What to buy as a consumer to maximize utility per dollar of expenditure, because I want to maximize total utility. So should I buy the apple or should I buy the pear, that kind of thing? Or they tell me what has profit potential, right? And if there's more profit potential in porn than in dialysis machines, I'll be producing porn, not dialysis machines. And all the time I'll rationalize it, saying, I'm really sorry. But see, I'm an executive. I'm responsible to my shareholders. I can believe that, right? And I have to protect shareholder value. Really? Come on. And then from that, what question determines how the resources will be allocated? Resources like what? Like trees. Like rivers, like water, like air, like people. Resources, many of which once they're gone forever. You can't renew them. Some of them you can renew, but some of them are gone for good. Right? So your decision better be right. Your what decision? Okay? Better be right. And if you have a society that's based on money, means no money, no what? No access to the what? No votes, no dollar votes. You see? Just imagine, you have 1,000 people with $1, okay? Versus one person with $1,000. Do the 1,000 people with $1 each have the same collective voting power as the one person with 1,000? No, because the 1,000 people have dispersed utility functions that cancel each other out. Whereas the one person with $1,000 has a what? Only one utility function to speak for. So that one person can what? Determine which idiot's going to be in the White House? Because that's about money, is it not? Sure as heck isn't about genius. Huh? I mean, is this being too rough? Don't you find it remarkable that in a country like this with so many brilliant, talented people, the best we could come up with from the menu is two pampered preppy punks, both of whom belong to a racist, misogynistic, sadistic, satanic cult known as Skull and Bones? Neither of whom will discuss their membership. I love that part too. You're running for access to the codes to launch nuclear war, but you don't want to discuss the organizations you belong to. When I was in the military, I can tell you this, I had a very high level clearance in the military. And I can tell you this right now, when they asked me the dope question, I didn't have the chance of saying, well, I'm not going to say yes, I'm not going to say no. Let's just say I had a reckless youth up until 41 years old. When they asked me what organizations I belong to, I had to answer them because the organizations I belong to say something about me, don't they? If I belong to the Ku Klux Klan and I was running for president, would that be an issue? Yeah, it should be. It bears on my intellect, on my fitness to hold office, my trustworthiness, my moral character, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, what's the difference? You got a crappy Ku Klux Klan. Basically. And so all this stuff about the wonders of the market, which we celebrate in our textbooks, people are looking at us abroad and saying, who the hell are you to talk to us about civilization and progress? Who are you? You're overweight, your kids are screwed up, half your class has got ADD, ADHD. Got an ADD society. It's like one gigantic Jerry Springer show.
And we're all on
antidepressants. And yeah, and we're QB too. What do you want? And one of the messages, in my case, I lived a lot of years outside this country. I lived in different languages, in India and some other places. And since I've been back, I'm hearing even some of my friends getting more hostile and more militant all the time. And saying to us, we're tired of it. We're tired of your definitions of efficiency. We're tired of your triumphalism and your bullying. And telling us that we can't have an independent foreign policy while you demand one for yourself. That we can't be sovereign, but you scream sovereignty all over the place for yourself. You even refuse to join the International Criminal Court. Because you said, what, we might put some of our war criminals on trial? Right? And we what? We will not allow, as a matter of sovereignty, what? Our people to be tried in one of the foreign courts? Is that not what Mr. Bush said? Well, then take, what about sovereignty? Take him out. Let him loose. The head of a sovereign state being tried in a foreign court? Turn him loose. Right? See? And people are tired of it. And we've seen from the situation with Iraq and so on that we're extended. That's how every empire has fallen. It's been internal, not external. Mm-hmm. The cause, the fundamental basis, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So this energy around the world, you see it if you read anything other than the 4 media outlets here. This wave is coming constantly. And Americans aren't going to know about it until it's crashing on their heads. Because our media isn't looking at it. So, I mean,
we're not looking
as this equalization, this all this stuff that's about to happen, and is it happening every day, is it just going to crash on us all at once like it did on those other empires?
No.
You believe that?
No, those other empires didn't crash all at once either. No. They crashed in increments. No. No. But the point is, how many Vietnams do you think we can handle?
Yeah. But we don't see it as a people, obviously, or we'd be up in arms.
We've gone from surpluses to what? Big time. Really, really serious deficit debt situation that we're in.
The signs are there. It's just we're not looking.
Which empire? See, which empire thought it would fall?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which one said, "Hey, you know, our days are numbered. So let's party hard."
A country that doesn't have a manufacturing gross domestic product doesn't make it.
But here's
and that's
another,
what's happening.
But we're also up, and this is for you guys here going to school. You're up against some very, very tough competition. Really tough. You got to be with the program. It means you got to have the skills that piece of paper says you're supposed to have. I was in a position not long ago, won't get into it, when it was, doesn't matter. But a position where some people applied to teach economics. And we had one of them became a doctorate, one of them became a master's degree. As I'm interviewing them, I ask a simple question. Explain cross-price elasticity demand to me. Explain the real-world uses of it. Neither one of them could answer that. That's week 3 of my course. Why? They're both wanting to teach economics. Both got the paper. And couldn't even answer a basic question. This is week 3 in my classes. In fact, we're freaked out that I asked a technical question. Now I'm setting exams for our hiring. Everybody's going to take exams that my students have taken. And they'll have 0, 1, or 2 correct answers. And the ones without a correct answer don't have none of the above. It's just leave it blank. And there's extra off for wrong answers. It means you can't guess, right? You have to know it. Why do I have to do that kind of stuff? Why can't I trust the degrees? Why can't I trust that people have the skills that the piece of paper says they're supposed to have? There you go. There you go. Everybody wants to go to heaven. Nobody wants to die. Everybody wants a piece of paper. They don't want to put the sweat equity in to get it. And to have a piece of paper that's worth something, and to have skills behind that piece of paper. Right? And globalization, guess what? It's working another way. I'm sure some of you have seen it already. For example, in India, when you go in India, where I used to live, to graduate high school, you must be fluent in 3 languages. They start calculus in grade 7. And you take an SSLC, Secondary School Leaving Certificate exam, 6-day exam, 5.5 hours per day for 6 days. Mathematics, biology, physics, chemistry, economics, 3 languages, Hindi, the state language, and English. The exam is in English. And if you fail, it's all over. You don't go anywhere. It's number coded, so you can't fix it. That's what globalization means for us here. We're up against some people who are lean, mean, and very hungry, and very talented, and very energetic. And they mean business. Because they come from societies where there's no welfare, there's no old age, there's no whining to profs. Oh, this test is too hard. Then leave. Then just leave. Right? That's my answer. This is too hard, then get yourself prepared or go work somewhere else. But don't drag my standards down to your slovenly level. It's not going to happen. And what we're seeing with globalization now is not only the spread of our ideas and labor and so on that way, but we're seeing it what bounce back. It's called a blowback. Right now, for example, only 20% of the graduate engineers in the United States are native-born. 80% of our graduate engineers are foreign-born. Why? Because you've got to do math. And the colleges are just as bad because the colleges, in order to pack in bodies and revenues, are lowering their own standards. Eastern's got a degree program in engineering, you don't have to take math. It's wonderful. Tell me which bridge you built so I don't have to drive on. True or not? And so what we have this deal going is we've been too fat too long. And now it's reckoning time. And so globalization, some may take comfort in the spread of American ideas and values and whatever. Some take comfort in that. But remember something, it's also coming back. And some people cannot handle that. Our ethnic compositions and our populations are changing, right? Our diets are changing. When I do this in classes, you know, for example, here we get diets, for example. Right? It's the fastest growing cuisine in the United States. Latino, and then after that, Asian. Diets are changing. All sorts of tastes and preferences are changing that have impacts on what? On American markets, on American jobs, on American tax revenues, and so on. And the problem is to be ready to handle it. How many people here speak another language? Fluently. Okay. I'd suggest the other guys get into it.
But you know, don't you think that's part of our system? I mean, the perfect time to start language is when you're a kindergartner.
No. You can start anytime.
Yeah, but you hear what I'm saying? I'm saying that the young people in Europe, I don't know about other countries.
That's true.
But in Europe, they know about 5 different languages. But they start when they're little.
That's true. But you can't
learn
as an adult. Anybody can learn. just a matter of motivation and focus and discipline. Do you know the discussion I had in China, for example? One of the things is I'm going over there to work. They asked me to work in land reform, in land tenure systems. I'll be working for the Chinese Ministry of Education. And when I was over there, they asked me about doing a deal with our institution. And in fact, I brought one of the professors who's from Yunnan University, who's here with me. I took him to Native Reserves because he's from one of the national minorities of China, from the Baidu people. And when I was talking to them over there, I asked them, what kind of deal do you want? And they said, well, here's the deal. We don't want to send our kids over there. We're tired. You know, coming back pregnant, purple hair. Safety pins through the nose. Okay. Lord knows what else. So they said, the deal we want is for you to bring your people over here to teach English for us over here on our side. And to set that up. And then we'll send people over there to teach Chinese. Because Chinese is going to become a major language of business, mm-hmm. as it's already becoming. Mm-hmm. And so, from an educational point of view, see, this is another thing about globalization. What does this mean for education? Well, what it means for education is a whole new, not completely new, but partially new skill set that's required for survival in the 21st century. The old days of training for a particular job, right? I'm going to do what my dad did. My dad worked at the mill. You know, my dad worked at James River. 30 years, he got a crummy gold watch, and I'm going to be at James River. You know, those days are gone. Mm-hmm. Average person will be changing careers in a big time way, probably 5 to 7 times in their lifetime. That means that what's required is rather than training for a job, what's required is to train for a basket of skills and capabilities. And so the issue of paradigm is critical to this whole discussion. And that's why I started that, and that's why I end with that. Unlike my previous professors, I don't have the truth. Sorry, I used it when I was 18, and I lost it. And I never found it since then. So I don't have the truth, sorry. All I can do is to help explore some perspectives, right? And this is where you'll see generally the debate falling. And what they see as causes and what they see as effects are very, very different. You see? Very, very different. For some people, a clash of cultures is something to be welcomed. For example, one of the things we're seeing right now is this with more homogenization. We're seeing, paradoxically, more tribalism. Are we not? Because as people become more and more homogenized, people retreat to whatever differences, whatever uniqueness they've got left. And so we're seeing, paradoxically, on a global level, with more and more homogenization of certain cultures, people retreating to more and more tribalism and more differentiation and so on amongst themselves. And one appears to be beginning the other. Just like in your own culture, right? When you see your own culture being destroyed, what do? You try to hang on. You try to keep whatever is left of it in the face of an onslaught that's taking place. Again, this portends some serious dangers here. Very, very serious dangers. Because we're seeing tribalism not only on a global level, but we're seeing it within nations. We're seeing nations within them increasingly fragmented and polarized. And in this country, for example, it's not just blue states versus red states. It's a lot more than that. A lot more than that. But we're seeing what? Literally a 50-50 split in certain senses on this country, are we not? We're seeing vitriol and anger like the likes of which we've never seen before.
Civil war.
Oh, the borderline, right? Yeah. I mean, I don't mean to impose my personal view, but I've studied the 2000 election, and I'm studying this one right now. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt in my mind it was stolen. There's no doubt in my mind.
There was no doubt in my mind. I told my family that the 2004 was going to be what it was, because once it was there, it wasn't going to leave.
You can't do all this if you can't control the vote. You can't.
That's true.
Yeah. So, you know, as much as I'd like you know, for all Americans to hear your lecture, I'm not sure why center and left is even up there, because, I mean, there's obviously one dominating power, and as you say, power begets power, and there's virtually no global governance over this. It's kind of like economic anarchy. So, I mean, is it just, I mean, is this really just spelling out how we're going, you know, what is going to be our downfall? Or is there hope in subversion? Is that what you're saying? Subversion would be the ultimate.
Well, it's like, my website, I mean, people say to me, you mean you admit to being a radical? Of course I do. Of course I do. Absolutely. The word radical comes from the Latin word radix, which means root. Radical is somebody who believes in getting to the root of the crap. What's wrong with that?
If I've got a headache, and you give me an aspirin, you may have done me a favor, unless what's causing a headache is a brain tumor. In which case, giving me an aspirin is even worse than giving me nothing, because you've delayed effective diagnosis and treatment of the problem. If you had a form of cancer, and the only alternative is radical surgery to death,
which would you take? Would you mind the surgeon getting a little radical? I don't think so. So I don't run from that word at all, because I know the origin of the root, right?
It means getting to the root, getting below the surface of things, to the essence of things, which is the task of science. That's what science is about. Getting below the surface of things, to the essence of things. And the reason, in answer to your question, the reason I started out like this is because I was never given that in school. That's why. All I got was the revealed truth of my illustrious profs. I didn't get the perspectives, because most of them didn't know the perspectives. All they knew was their own crap. They didn't know the other schools of thought. Just like most religious people don't only know their own stuff. They don't even know any points of view, because they're locked in their own little world. And to be educated means to be able to walk a mile in another person's shoes. It doesn't mean you have to agree with them, but it means to understand where they're coming from, right? To understand their syllogism. Because some of these syllogisms are very, very dangerous. I mean, look at, if I change it from here, country X, you know, country A equals terrorism, right? Terrorism equals evil, and so on, you know? It may be a surprise to you, but there's a whole bunch of countries today who consider us the number one source of state-sponsored terrorism in the world today, and they have good evidence behind them. They're not just practicing rhetoric. They have some solid, solid evidence behind them. If you define terrorism, right, as calculated violence against non-combatants, okay? Just that way. Calculated or highly likely, highly foreseeable violence against non-combatants. If that's your definition of terrorism, then tell me what an embargo is. Tell me what an embargo is that denies food and medicine to children who have nothing to do with Saddam Hussein. Over 500,000 children have died because of our embargo in the last 9 years, 9 to 10 years. What is that? Tell me what that is. Because we're Americans, we do it, it's not terrorism, is that it? Then what do words mean then? It's like Alice from Looking Glass. When I use the word Humpty Dumpty said in a rather scornful tone, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less. The question is, said Humpty Dumpty, whether one can make words mean so many different things. Said Alice. Humpty Dumpty said, no, the question is which is to be master, that's all. So we presume to define progress versus backwardness. Truth versus lie. Moral versus immoral. Right versus wrong. Defense versus offense. And our days are numbered in terms of being able to do that. And there are powers on the horizon. China's one of them, but there are others. Collectively, the European Union is another one. On the horizon. And they need to do exactly this. These imperatives govern us as individuals. Like for me, if I don't continually read, and continually what? Redevelop my knowledge base, my skill base, then relative to my competitors, then what? Then I can't do this, which means I can't do this, which means I can't do this, which means I can't continue to do this. So this applies to whole nations. When we take our critical savings, and instead of putting the savings into roads and infrastructure and bridges and telecommunications and water, you understand? Instead we put it into 30-second trades of the stock market and paper shuffling that do nothing for the productive base of this nation as a whole or any particular enterprise in particular. What are we doing?
When we're sitting here using money to call our brokers at 6:30 and telling them to make, put a buy order at 6:30 and a sell order at 6:45. What's that do for productivity? What does that do for the competitiveness? Does nothing. You know that well, as well as I do. And one of the things with globalization that's been going on is that finance capital, as a share of total capital, has been increasing exponentially. Industrial capital is being hollowed out. Agricultural capital has gone to agribusiness. Small family farms have been destroyed. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing more concentration and centralization. Economic concentration means fewer firms controlling larger market shares. Centralization means fewer interlocking power groups controlling larger and larger asset shares. Both processes of economic concentration as well as centralizations feed each other. And so what we're seeing now is a few corporations able to make the critical decisions of what, how, and for whom. You understand? They're able to appropriate the voice to use our precious resources in the interest of a few and to define for us what is moral and immoral, what is national security. And meanwhile, we have a media. And see, the media is no better because, look at, for the, here's how it works for the media, which is becoming globalized. Access brings the scoop. The scoop brings exposure. Exposure makes you a name, like Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw. The name gives you more access. But you only get to continue in that game as long as you, what, don't ask nasty little questions. You've all seen little George, have you not, punishing journalists, saying, I'm not calling on you because that question you asked last time. It's all seen that. So media, it's in their interest not to get radical, not to ask substantive questions. Why? Because if they do, they don't get called on. They lose the scoop. They lose the exposure. It's not a conspiracy. It's just plain self-interest. You ask the average journalist, has your editor ever told you what to write or what not to write? No, of course not. It's because they didn't have to. Right? That's how teachers are hired. That's why we have tenure vetting. So we make sure we get the right kind of people. We don't let some freaks slide in there. My father used to say, first-rate people, I have first-rate people, because part of being first-rate is you can recognize and embrace and value competence rather than fear. Second-rate people hire third and fourth-rate because they look good. And the third and fourth-rate go on to hire fifth and sixth-rate so they look good, and mediocrity metastasizes like a cancer. One of the problems we've got in this country here, another one, is the whole culture of networking and bootlicking and whatever. Because generally people who do networking and bootlicking are people who lack substance. That's why they do networking and bootlicking. And one of the problems that we also have is this whole culture, the Rotarians and all the rest of this crap, where people are fixing jobs for each other and whatever. And what's happening is people are not being hired on the basis of merit and capabilities, but being hired on who they know and whatever. And when you were competing globally against other places where that is not the case, where you don't get hired unless you're in the program, unless you are a very, very capable person. Yeah.
So what can a citizen do to avoid getting trapped in that kind of system? What's something you can do as a person?
First of all, find a market niche and become very, very good at what you do. Because freedom is when people need you more than you need them. One of my favorite metaphors is imagine a guy from Ku Klux Klan. Hardcore racist, okay? Really hardcore. We're talking psychopathic racist, okay? Now he's out in the woods with his little Johnny, the apple of his inbred eye. And little Johnny falls from a tree, right? Suffers skull fracture and subdural hematoma. So the guy takes little Johnny into the hospital. And the only neurosurgeon available has any chance of saving little Johnny, and she's black. He's got two choices: get an attitude adjustment real quick, or you get a dead little Johnny, which might improve the gene pool a bit. Freedom. So the answer to this is understand the game. You can't stop this. this isn't something you can turn on and move off like a light switch. It's systemic. But you can understand it. Just like you can't stop a hurricane, but you can understand the precursors of one and get out of the way. Right? Just like over there, it happened in tsunami thing. Most people who died, what? They weren't locals, because the locals knew. The locals knew the signs. They knew when that water goes down, it means something big is coming up. They start running like hell, right? It was the tourists. Oh, that's cool. Far out. The tide's out. Let's go digging. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So the question is, rather, how not to stop the breadline, but how to be happy in it.
That's your own choice. I can't. Yeah.
So, I mean, this is inevitable. The question is rather not how you can stop it, but how to cope.
Yeah, how to cope, right. And what it's about. And how to find a margin of freedom for yourself. And it's up to you how far beyond that you want to go. But understand what's happening here. It's like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde process. It's like a good news, bad news thing. But the thing about it is what it takes today to be, you know, considered, quote, educated, unquote, is very different than when I went to school. Very different. And the real focus is learning on how to learn and how to update your own knowledge in a systematic fashion and how to learn new things and become your own teacher. Yeah. Remember, Mark Twain once said, a person who doesn't read good books has no advantage over a person who can't read. Okay?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I can't accept that I can just cope because the things that we're doing are jeopardizing our existence on this little ball we call Earth. If you ruin the trees and the water, it's over. So I'll throw myself in front of the machine as often as I can.
Me too, but I don't want to make a judgment of brothers.
No. I'm just saying. It seems to me that more people that were decided to disconnect and say no.
Right. But you see, go back to, and I'll leave you with this metaphor. Go back to the metaphor I gave you before about the curve. See, as a teacher, I got a power to impose a curve or not. I have a power to impose a system or not. Right? I have the power to create a scarcity of A's as well as a scarcity of F's. But I don't have the power, and I can predict how you'll behave in your own self-interest. But maybe part of it is redefining what's really in your interest. And part of it is reconceptualizing about the mind. That's why I went to the micro-macro question with you. Because it's very much to the point. How you see yourself. If I see myself as an atomistic, isolated individual, the one that's celebrated by neoclassical economics, right? Economic man incarnate. Maximizer of pleasure, income, profit, minimizer of pain and suffering, right? If that's all I am, and I have no obligation to other human beings, if that's my working model of me as a person and people in general, that causes me to behave toward others and as well as toward my own interest in a very different way. See, then if I have another kind of view of my role on this earth, it's like in Germany. There were some Germans who said, what? Me, right? I'm not Jewish, I'm not gay, I'm not, you know, Sinti Roma. I'm sorry about those people, but hey, you know, we got Autobahn, got Volkswagens, I'm proud to be German again. You know, sorry about those people, but hey. And besides, you know, the people have been hating them for thousands of years. They must have hated them for some reason. What happened to those people with that kind of narrow, selfish, myopic view of themselves and humanity in general? They wound up turning tricks for candy bars and nylon 12 years later, or they wound up on trial in Nuremberg. So part of it, that's why I included this macro-micro question. How we see ourselves, how we see society. Is society something merely the sum of the individuals in it? There's no such thing as society? Or is it, the liberal, for example, says what? The conservative says the macro is the sum of the micros. That's conservative thought. The liberal says the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. The liberals focus on synergy and complementarity and whatever. The radical says the whole may be greater or less than the sum of its parts because of contradictions in that whole that cause movements against each other.
with the constituent elements pulling away from each other, against each other, you can have the whole less than the sum of its parts. And that's the question for us as globalization proceeds and our own role in globalization proceeds. What is happening to the whole? Is it becoming, is it simply equal to the sum of its part? Is it greater than the sum of its part? Or perhaps even less than the sum of its parts? Because the parts are not working together. They're engaging in self-destructive behavior. And they have a date with history. Because these countries out there outnumber us. So we've seen from the case of Iraq, we can't even handle Iraq. My gosh, can you imagine? You want to do Iran too? And North Korea? Good luck. And all of these people who are saying this, Bush, Cheney, the rest of them, every one of them, they had a chance to go put their own bodies on the line, didn't they? And where were they?
How many black helicopters are flying over your house? Should we be in the sea with you? How many government lists are you on? Let's put it that way.
Probably many. But you see, I've never committed a crime. I'm committing no crimes except what? Daring to say what I'm saying?
That's not a crime.
Yeah, well, these days it can be.
Yeah, it can be.
You know?
But stuff is put that away from us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, but, and see, what can I say? Counter views are welcome. Counter arguments are welcome. Counter arguments is welcome.
You've been listening to A Radical Blackfoot Teaches the Economics of Globalization with Professor of Economics James Craven of Clark College, given at the Globalization of Homelessness and Poverty Community Lecture Series at Washington State University in Vancouver, January 27th, 2005. You can download an MP3 of this and all previous episodes of the show at the Unwelcome Guests website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you so much for listening.
They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest. I treat horses good. Saddle will always be filled by